everyone, and welcome to minute 52 of season 5 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Hal Bryan of the Rocketeer Minute. And I really appreciate, Hal, that you're taking time off of your busy day as you're flying around Oshkosh and talk to us a little bit about Die Hard 2. So welcome back, Hal.
Well, it's great to be back, Rob. This is, it's so much fun to sit and talk movies and nerd out a little bit with anybody who's like-minded. So, having a great time so far.
Cool. Great. I hopefully that'll continue all week, and hopefully, all the listeners will also enjoy themselves, listening to our conversation. So, minute 52 begins with Khan continuing his update, ends with John responding accordingly. So yesterday we ended things. John and Barnes were trying to figure out how to unscramble the millions of possibilities on this walkie-talkie. And then we're back in the church, and then we have Dick Gordon show up, and not the Dick Gordon that people are thinking when they think of Robin, but the real Dick Gordon, the Apollo 12 astronaut from the Earth to the Moon. And to understand what we're talking about, you have to listen to yesterday's episode. hint, hint. And so the Khan shows up and continues to explain to everyone around him what's going on. And he says, "We just monitored a call from their chief engineer. Our people took out their SWAT team completely." And then Garber looks over and goes, "You were right. They went for the antenna array. We're right on schedule." So first of all, I like the fact that they're showing us that, how in tune this whole team is. They have everything set up except for John McClane. That's the monkey in the wrench, as John said in the first Die Hard.
Right.
They have everything completely planned out really well. They know what's going to happen. They know that they can monitor Barnes's conversation. We'll talk a little bit this minute as to how actually they're doing that, because it's a little confusing, because he's apparently on a cell phone. And we know a little bit more about cell phones today than people did 33 years ago when they made this movie.
Right.
How are they monitoring this call? I mean, they can monitor, I guess, if he's calling on a cell phone, so he must be calling another phone or something, in the control tower, so therefore they're going to be able to hear it. Okay. I can sort of buy that. They've tapped into the phone lines in the tower. But you would also think that maybe, we never see anyone on the other side of that call. So, is Trudeau speaking, to him on a phone? Is it on a speaker? Is it on a cell phone? We never know. So if any of those things, it could be. If it's just a cell phone to cell phone, then as we know today, it would be much difficult for them to monitor a call like that.
Right.
Not
Although, it's
impossible,
interesting. Yeah,
but
we talked yesterday about scramblers and things, and I was talking about people with police scanners. Right around this time, it used to be that if you had a police scanner and you knew which frequencies to listen for, you could pick up phone calls. I mean, through without really even trying. Sorry, early cell phone calls. And I remember very vividly being over at a friend's house who had a police scanner. And they set it toward a new block of frequencies they didn't normally monitor. And after about 10 minutes, sure enough, we heard sitting there listening to somebody's phone call, which is, we weren't proactively trying to do it, but it was technically illegal as could be. But cell phone signals back then and cell phone calls are actually very easy to listen to.
But back then, but today they're probably a
Back then.
little right. I don't think you'd
Yeah,
pick
it's
them
a
up on a
very
police
different
scanner
game
these
now.
days. Yeah,
No, absolutely not.
because you have to remember your 4-digit or 6-digit PIN.
Yes, exactly. And there are, what, dozens of combinations?
Yes, of course. As long as you're not using 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so you're good.
Right.
So then, Stewart looks over at them and says, "Losing our team wasn't part of the plan." Now, when does someone make a plan that they're going to lose part of their team?
Right. I mean, you may go into it thinking, okay, we can allow for some attrition. We can have contingencies in case we lose somebody. But otherwise,
it's not
really overstating the obvious.
That's right. I mean, again, if you talk about what happened in Die Hard 1, I mean, you have Johnson & Johnson say, okay, you know, we're willing to lose 20-25% of the hostages. You know, I could live with that.
Right.
But it's not your men, basically, that type of thing. You know, because again, there are only a dozen of them. You know, if you think about it, there's a dozen of them and five are dead. Okay, so there's seven guys right now that are taking care of all of this. Which is just mind blowing that seven guys can take control of. So you know a lot about aviation. Okay, a control tower the size of Dulles, can seven people or six and a leader and a commander control everything easily with probably little to no training?
Right. The training piece of it is huge. I mean, that's, you know, I think that's one of the bigger holes. I mean, I couldn't honestly tell you off the top of my head without checking with another buddy of mine, Chris Henry, who did the Apollo 13 minute with Jim O'Kings. He's a former traffic controller. So he has much better hands-on insight than I do, but it seems like a stretch, but the training aspect of it is what would just make it, you know, completely implausible.
Yeah. Well, come on, they've been training for 3-4 days. You know, they knew that Esperanza was going to be moved. You know, I mean, we talked a little bit about this, I think last week or the week before, where, you know, they didn't have that much time to plan all this. So, you know, unless part of what their team does is, you know, deal with taking over airport, you know, like little airports during coups or something like that. You know, it is possible.
You know, the way their equipment looks, and they've got these sort of modular stations with radar and computer terminals and CRTs. It does kind of look like it's, you know, it's something that they could sort of package up and then bring in. And you know, there's certainly military precedent for temporary traffic control facilities under hostile conditions and stuff. So I could kind of buy that this is a group of people who is, you know, maybe sort of able to do that. But it's interesting, though, because I might be getting ahead of myself, but we're talking about not just the tower, but, you know, they're pretending to be Dulles Approach, which is a whole different facility. It's usually in a whole different building that might be miles and miles and miles away from any airport.
Okay. All right. You're right. We will get into that because a little spoiler, the script deals with that, but the movie doesn't. You know, the movie glosses over that idea. That's a completely different person speaking. But we'll get there later this week. All right.
So apologies. I thought really.
No, that's okay. Hal, it's fine. It's great. It's great. It's not yet. Not in this minute. Because in this minute, he's, you know, right now we're going to have Stuart talk, but it's only to the tower. You know, he's not talking yet to any of the planes. And then we see him go over to what looks like a phone line and then punches in. And if you really spend 5 minutes scrolling back and forth, you can figure out that it looks like he's punching into the phone 5877. I have no idea what the significance is of that, but that's what he seems to have, pushed in. And then he goes, attention, Dulles Tower. Attention, Dulles Control Tower. Mr. Trudeau, I know you're listening. Unfortunately, you're not obeying. And then we get a shot in the control tower and we see Trudeau and he goes, try me face to face and we'll see. Which it's really funny, you know, hearing him, you know, talk this way, you know, that he's giving a tough response to nobody because nobody can, you know, obviously Stuart can't hear him. But I mean, what I like is the fact that Stuart knows the name of the, you know, head of the airport. You know, he knows that it's Trudeau. He knows that Trudeau's the guy he spoke to. So again, he's done his homework.
That's true.
This isn't just
what you would expect from somebody like this.
Exactly. But again, they don't have that much time to plan for this whole thing because, you know, if you think about it, how much in advance is it decided that Esperanza is going to be extradited? you know, and when their plane is going to go, and is the plane going to go to Dulles or National? You know, it could go to either of the airports. So, you know, they were able to get their info and, you know, use their whatever intelligence they have, intelligence information, to find this information out. But it's not like they know this weeks in advance. This is something that is days, if not hours. I mean, you'd think they would have kept this a little bit more of a secret. So, I don't know.
Yeah, security is not very impressive at this point.
No, not at all. You know, come on, it's pre-9/11. No one was planning on doing anything. No one thought that these type of things could happen. You know,
yeah, that's fair.
And then
you want to talk about things that have changed. My gosh, the whole atmosphere around airports and commercial air travel pre and post 9/11.
Yeah, of course.
That's really underscored here.
Yes. Well, it's underscored from the fact that, you know, that there's so many things that, you know, that goes on in this movie or in any movies at this time. You know, how close you can get to the gate if you don't have a ticket, you know, like where you can be. You know, just little things like that. What you're allowed to carry with you, you know. But yeah, you know, they have fake porcelain guns. So you know that's something that you can, you know, even post 9/11, you can use fake porcelain guns, you know, because they don't exist.
Exactly.
So, and then you know, they give us a shot of John and Barnes both listening into this conversation via the cell phone. So this is the thing I mentioned before. How is that work? How does that work? You know?
Yeah, it's, well, and you know, this, the phone setup that he's using, I mean, it looks like one of those, like a modern version of sort of an army, you know, field phone. And as you said, maybe it's sort of connected directly into physical phone lines and stuff, but it's over the, you know, over the speakers in the tower, and then we're listening just on a cell phone. And I think anybody who's near a speaker of any kind is just somehow magically hearing this conversation.
Right. And I love the way that Barnes picks up the phone to listen in, and then John like grabs the phone away from him. You know, it's like, I'm the one who wants to listen to this. But again, I guess we're just going to have to, you know, assume that there's some way that this cell phone is picking up this information. You know, it's able to pick it up. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, this is a movie that asks you to make a lot of assumptions.
Yes.
And that's one of them.
Mm-hmm, correct. And that's part of the fun of it. You know, it's the suspension of disbelief.
Absolutely.
For this type of thing. I mean, a friend of mine told me years ago, he said, when you watch a movie, you have to believe that in their world, that's the way things work. And that's it. And once you do that, you're like, okay, it's not our world. In our world, things would be different. But in their world, okay, it works. They have cell phones that can listen into what's going on in the tower.
Right.
There you go.
And I absolutely agree with that. But for me, you know, the movie has to earn that for me.
Correct. No, I agree.
It's got to be good enough that I'm willing to do that. You know, as long as I see that the effort's there, then I'll kick back, relax, and be entertained like everybody else.
Okay, and this movie fits into that category for you?
It did when it came out. This one hasn't, to me, hasn't aged nearly as well as the first one overall.
Okay.
It's just that the holes are just too big and too impossible.
Do you think it's because do you think it's because you have firsthand knowledge of aviation and stuff like that? Do you think that
I think that's got to be a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of it. Some law enforcement experience probably informs a little bit of it. I still have a ton of fun watching any of the films, but I somehow, for me, there's just a big drop from the original to this one, and then the sequels that follow.
Okay, I mean, there are plenty of flaws in the first one too, but you know, as you know, the reason we do these minute by minute is. You know, not because we're looking for flaws to make fun of the movie, the exact opposite. We're just looking to have a hell of a fun time talking about it, you know, and you point out things that don't make sense, and you try to find some reasoning for how it works.
Right, exactly. You know, what were they thinking? What went into the creation of it? And I hadn't watched it in quite a while. I've seen the first one many, many times over the years and haven't watched this one in ages. And it was a ton of fun to go back and watch it again.
Well, I'm glad to help you do that. So
I owe you for that one, Rob.
All right. Sounds good to me. And then Stuart continues talking and says, "You were warned not to try to restore your systems. You've wasted lives and precious time on a futile and obvious target. Now you're going to pay the penalty." So what do you know, like, the official definition of penalty, like what that means?
I know what the term means, but I don't know the etymology of it off the top of my head.
Right. Okay. So first of all, the definition is a punishment imposed for breaking a law, rule, or contract. I guess in this case, maybe they're talking that it's breaking a rule because, you know, Stuart gave them rules that they had to follow in order to do it. Even though, again, you know, we can go back and say, well, if they had actually paid attention to his rules at the beginning, they could have just sent all the airplanes to other airports and that would have been it. You know, the movie would have been a lot shorter.
That's true. That would have, yes.
I mean, you think
could have just all wrapped up right at the beginning.
That's right. You think that even in 1990, the protocol was that if something like this happens, if you get a chance, you divert all aircraft, and that's it.
Right.
You don't say go to the outer marker.
Yeah, exactly. There's so many other airports to choose from, and I mean, some of these airplanes would have had enough fuel to make it. Practically to Chicago or someplace, that's, you know, right. Way, way out there.
That's right. Right. So the term originated in the 16th century. And it comes from the Latin word polynalitas, which basically comes from the word meaning pain, which is interesting because penalty, you know, comes from pain. So, you know, I guess the
interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then, you know, for some reason or somehow, John is able to get in on this conversation, you know, which is great. It goes back to what we were saying before. It makes no sense in our world, but I guess in their world, you can then talk on the cell phone and everyone can hear you, you know, everyone in the tower. Exactly. And, you know, Stuart can even hear you in the church. You know, even though he's a few blocks away, but he can still hear it. And John goes, "I got 5 dead officers down here, Colonel Stuart. Isn't that penalty enough?" And then stupidly, Carmine, you know, flips the switch for speaker by him and goes, "McLean, you keep out of this. You've been nothing but a pain." And then he gets like a dirty look from Trudeau. And Lorenzo realizes that he just made a big mistake, you know, but it reminds me of the idea that, you know, nowadays we have similar issues that sometimes, you know, instead of hitting reply, you hit reply all. You know, that's probably the closest, yes. the closest, you know, modern analogy is reply and reply all, as opposed to, you know, for what, you know, Lorenzo is doing here. And
it's a great, great analogy.
Yeah. And then Stuart has a great line at that point, because then he goes, "Oh, McLean, John McLean, the policeman hero who saved the Nakatomi hostages. I read about you in People magazine. You seemed out of your league on Nightline, though." And, you know, so first of all, it shows that first of all, John is, you know, he became some sort of overnight superstar. Because here you have, you know, a powerful army general that knows who John McClane is, you know, and that he's, you know, and we also find out that he reads People magazine and watches Nightline. You know, those are important things to know. But, you know, if in our world, you or me or anyone else would hear of somebody who saved the day somewhere, the odds of you remembering who they were and the connection to, you know, to where it is, you know, and also, I mean, Lorenzo just said McLean. He didn't even say John McLean.
Right.
You know, he goes, McLean. Oh, well, if it's McLean, then there's only one McLean that it could be. You know, it must be. I mean, Stewart did bump into him earlier in the movie. Maybe at this point, you know, it hits him of who he was talking to. You know, that's possible. But
you can imagine him sort of putting two and two together and realizing that, you know, losing his team wasn't part of his plan, and that there is a fly in the ointment, and somebody inside is doing a really good job of screwing things up. And then he hears McLean, and you know, as he said, he could put two and two together.
Yeah, but no, it's plausible. It's just very funny that he's honing in on that name and that experience. Unless for Stewart, it was somehow a momentous day for him to hear, you know, on the day that he heard about this. And that's why he was reminded about it. You know, I don't know.
You know, or at this point in that universe, do groups of terrorists planning nefarious things, do they try to work up John McClane contingency plans? You know, what if we have a John McClane in the mix in our scenario, just like they did at Nakatomi? And
right.
I don't know. I'm stretching all over the place here because I'm trying to give them the benefit of every bit of the doubt. And really it was, you know, this is some exposition that tells us that people have heard of him.
Right.
You know, he was on Nightline. So
even Colonel
some
Stewart,
degree of notoriety.
That's right. Even Colonel Stewart has heard of him. You know, so, right. All right. What do you know about People Magazine? You know anything about it?
People Magazine?
Yes.
Not a great deal. I think I remember my mom subscribing probably in the early 80s. And let's see, they do their, you know, sexiest person alive covers or did. Beyond that, I'm going to kick back and let you enlighten me.
Okay. Do you have any idea what year it debuted?
No, I don't.
Okay. It debuted on February 25th, 1974.
Okay.
So I was a month and a half old when it debuted. I probably didn't read any of those articles at the time. And by 2009, their readership was up to 46.6 million adults. And they had the largest audience of any American magazine. And then in 2018, the readership declined to 35.9 million. You know, obviously because people read less magazines these days than they did back then. You know, I don't have, I mean, they obviously have a website and you can go, you know, check out things on their websites, but it's just not the same as, you know, when you would get your weekly People Magazine and read it over.
Right.
But, yeah, so, you know, and they have a whole bunch of different types of you know, shoot-offs of it that they were trying to get people more connected to it. You know, they had teen people and, you know, but they're mostly known for the idea of, you know, their celebrity photos and stories about celebrities, which I guess is borderline of like Inquirer type of information. But, you know, they try to be a little more real with the stories that they tell there. You know, they talk about famous people, but also, I guess, people like John McClane.
I always remember People Magazine being on a very different level than the true newspaper tabloids like National Enquirer and Weekly World News. I mean, it wasn't, serious, respectable journalism by any stretch of the imagination, but it was generally considered, you know, believable and plausible. You know, they didn't have Bat Boy on the cover,
right.
Like
exactly.
The World News was famous for.
That's right. An alien is having my baby type of things.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. All right. So let's move along to Nightline. What do you know about Nightline?
My picture, Ted Koppel. I think it was on ABC, maybe.
Yes.
It was ABC.
That is
correct.
ABC.
One of the
ABC.
Big three.
ABC.
Okay, I was right the first time.
Right. And
beyond that, no idea when it started or how long it ran.
Yeah. So it started in 1980, and Ted Koppel was a news program that went into in-depth interviews and stories about things that were going on around the world. It started right after the Iran crisis, The Iran hostage situation in 1979. So in 1980, right at the beginning, it started it. And then the Ted Koppel remained the anchor till 2005, when he retired. And he had a lot of interviews with some people that it was they were their first like big interviews, that, where they were able to where he was able to get some I guess juicy information about things that go on around the world and stuff like that. Came in 2005 by three different people. There were three anchors that were doing it all at the same time: Martin Bashir and Cynthia McFadden, and I mean and Terry Moran. So I find it really interesting that you take one person who's been doing a show for 25 years and you replace them with three different people because you just can't reach the same
Right.
level. So
Yeah, that was a remarkable career.
yes, it really was. And so it was a and Nightline is something that as far as I know, it's still going. Yeah, it's still going. It's been going around for over 40 years. The even in 2020 they had Ted Koppel make a guest appearance. And still going along. And then so John has a quip that he gives right at the end of this minute where he says, "Hey, Colonel, blow me." And that's pretty much how the minute ends. Which is a typical John McClane response. Do you think, okay, here I'm going to give you a little bit of a test that you're going to get the answer to in just 2 minutes from now, but do you think that that line is in the script, or do you think it was something that was ad-libbed by Bruce Willis?
No, that's a good question. I kind of want to think it was ad-libbed because, Willis just inhabits this character so easily and so comfortably. That that's going to be my guess, and I know I will be if I'm not right, I will be I will have chosen second place.
Exactly. You got a 50-50 chance on this one. So you have a good shot. You have a good shot. You have a better chance than winning the lottery. How's that?
Fair enough.
All right. So the script has a few minor changes. Mostly, once again, it goes into the descriptive nature of the whole thing. So we have Con Garber and Stewart talking, and they say that pretty much the exact same thing. And then it says he right after Stewart says the line, it says he comes to his decision, picks up the phone, speaks, voice flat, firm, stern. Around and above him, his men hover over the improvised screens and terminals. Now remember, there are only six guys that are hovering around him. but the script makes it sound like there's a whole army that's around him. And as he's talking, it says, in the control tower, they are listening, fearful. And then Stewart says, "You've wasted lives and time on a futile and obvious target." As opposed to the differences is, he says, "And precious time," as opposed to just time. I think precious time is actually better, the way he says it in the movie.
Right.
And then they, and then it shows McClane, and it says, "They hear this too over Barnes' cellular tie into the tower." McClane grabs it, he grabs the phone basically, and then he says about the five dead officers, which continues, the same way in the movie. And then it says, "This interchange is broadcast here." Lorenzo shouts into the phone, "McClane, keep out of this, you." He stops, seeing the chilling look Trudeau is giving him. And then it says, "Stewart has reacted to both the mention of his name and of McClane's. His brow furrows. Ah, yes, McClane, John McClane. The policeman hero who saved the Nakatomi hostages. I read about you in People magazine. You seemed out of your league on Nightline, though." And then John's response is very different. He says, "Yeah, Colonel, we were both famous for 5 minutes. Saw you get canned by Congress on TV." And then the rest of it will continue with tomorrow with the way that he says it. So you were correct that the line "blow me" was ad-libbed by Bruce Willis.
Oh,
Yeah.
terrific.
So you see, you get points for that.
Got to win one once in a
There you
while.
go.
There you
There
go.
you go. All right. So every Tuesday I have a segment called Disaster Tuesday. And this is basically because we're talking about a movie that has a plane crash which we will talk more in depth about next week and maybe even in 2 weeks from now. But so what I decided to do is I have a segment where I talk about some famous air disasters that happened that were connected to some real people. And I normally only choose one, but because Hal is the aviation guy on the show for this season, I decided I'm going to talk about three different people, but we'll go one at a time. So the first one we're going to talk about, do you know someone by the name of Ralph Johnston? Have you ever heard that name?
Boy, it's familiar. I mean, we can't say I can place it.
Okay. So Ralph Johnston was the first American to die while piloting an aircraft that crashed. Okay,
Thomas Selfridge was the first person to die, first military person to die in an airplane crash, but he was a passenger.
Okay.
So, but I didn't know that about
right. Ralph. So this happened in 1910. I don't know what year the guy you mentioned died, but this was in 1910. He and Archibald Hoxsey were known as the Heavenly Twins, because they were trying to break altitude records. They both actually worked for the Wright exhibition team. And 3 months before he died, he actually survived a different crash in Asbury Park, New Jersey. And then he was part of the International Aviation Tournament, which happened on October 27th, 1910 in Elmont, New York. And they were offering $3,700 for the person who got the highest altitude, another $1,000 for if they broke any world record, and $5,000 bonus for exceeding 10,000 feet. And he reached 8,471. And then he died on November 17th, 1910 in Denver in an air crash. He was flying a Model B. And they basically show that the wing got damaged on a previous landing, and he didn't repair it properly. He superficially repaired it, and the wing collapsed during flight, and therefore he plunged to his death in front of a whole crowd that came to watch the air show. I mean, think about it. It was 1910. There weren't that many people flying at that point. This was really something. To see. So the next person that I'm going to talk about is actually, I'm going to see if you know the name of the person. Okay. In 1966, there was a T-38 that crashed that had two famous people on it. Any idea? And it crashed in St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh, man.
St. Louis, Missouri. I'll give you a hint. It was featured in the first episode of From the Earth to the Moon.
Earth to the Moon. I know it was two astronauts. I think it would have been Gemini or Gemini, if you prefer, astronauts. I'm drawing a blank on the names. I think it was Elliot C.
That's correct. Elliot C.
Okay. I don't think I'm going to get
it. And the other one was Charlie Bassett.
Ah, okay.
All right. They were flying to St. Louis, and they crashed along the way, and they actually crashed into the McDonald Aircraft Building, which is where they were assembling their Gemini 9 aircraft that they were supposed to go up on.
Right.
Alan Shepard headed the investigation on it, and they found that there were aircraft maintenance problems. And that the weather was not very good that day, and they basically the cause of the crash was pilot error. That's what they basically said. And because of them, Thomas Stafford and Eugene Cernan were moved up to the primary position in Gemini 9, which allowed Jim Lovell and Buzz Aldrin take over Gemini 10.
Fateful thing, wasn't
That's
it?
That's correct, because they say that without Buzz Aldrin having the Gemini experience, he probably would not have been put on Apollo 11.
Man, amazing. You wonder why and how things work out like
That's
that.
That's correct.
That was just about exactly 20 years after that T-38, the astronaut crash. I lost a very good friend of mine in college who was a couple of years ahead of me, and he was flying a T-38 somewhere. He was in the Southwest, I would guess maybe Luke Air Force Base, and there was a bird strike, and it came right through the canopy and killed him immediately. And you know, that's aviation is one of those things that it's one of the most, you know, enjoyable, fun, beautiful, remarkable things we can do. But you know, if it ends very abruptly and very, very brutally.
Correct. Even for people with a lot of experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. And then the final one that I wanted to mention is it happened on October 5th, 1967. C.C. Williams. Do you know who that name is?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I don't think I do.
Okay, so C.C. Williams was actually the third member of the original Apollo 12.
Oh, okay.
Again, From the Earth to the Moon talks a lot about this. It's mentioned.
Right,
Alan Bean talks about it, that he wasn't supposed to be there, but because C.C. Crashed. So he was flying from...
Right, another T-38.
That's right. He was flying from Cape Canaveral to Houston. And he was stopping off in Mobile, Alabama to visit his father, who was dying of cancer. And he apparently had a mechanical failure caused by the aileron controls. You know what that is. I don't. It caused the aileron controls to jam on his T-37 near Tallahassee. And, the plane dove straight down and crashed. And he was actually able to eject, but he ejected at 1,500 feet. And apparently he was too close to the plane when it exploded. And, when it crashed. And he was also incinerated because he was landing right behind there. So they actually have a memorial for C.C. Williams and on the Apollo 12 patch. They actually have an extra star for him because he was supposed to be the one who was supposed to be there.
Oh, wow.
And they put his naval aviation wings and his silver astronaut pin on the lunar surface in his honor. That's what Alan Bean did when he was there on Apollo 12.
Yeah, I was going to say that part I remembered. I didn't think I could have told you about the patch and the extra star.
Yeah.
If you're wondering, or if anybody is curious, ailerons on an airplane are what control movement along we call the roll axis. So you move in three dimensions, and if you put your arms straight out like you're pretending to be an airplane, and then you tip one way or another, put your left arm down and your right arm up, that's banking or rolling, and that's the ailerons are the control surfaces on the wings that lets you do that.
Very cool. All right. Thank you for that information, Hal. So, Hal, you want to tell people once again how they can get in touch with you?
Sure. You can always catch up with the Rocketeer Minute podcast. The movie's 109 minutes, so it should mean 109 episodes, but we've done several extra ones after the fact, and there are probably more in the future. But you can find that at RocketeerMinute.com or any of the places you normally get podcasts. If you want to hear my colleagues and I that share hosting duties on a podcast, you can listen to The Green Dot, which is put out by the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. You can find those episodes all the same places, or you can go to inspire.eaa.org and click on podcasts and find them all there. And we've had a great time talking with celebrities, astronauts, test pilots, designers, you name it. It's been absolutely terrific. A couple of Apollo guys have joined us, and it's always always fascinating to talk to. So you can find more of me both of those places.
All right. Very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So, Hal, you feel like coming back again tomorrow?
Absolutely. Let's keep going with this. We got more to talk about.
Excellent. Yes, we definitely do. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and